Whoever you are, wherever you come from, whomever you love, we welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. May you leave your daily burdens at the door, open your mind and hearts, and be fully present for this time of fellowship and spiritual re-energizing. I'm Reverend Christy Anderson, an ordained interfaith minister and commissioned lay leader of this congregation. I'm joined today by our worship associate, Mary Lou Hawley, and our director of music, Hal Walker.
We light our chalice with these words from John Muir. Every morning, arising from the death of sleep, the happy plants and all our fellow animal creatures, great and small, and even the rocks seemed to be shouting, "Awake, awake, rejoice, rejoice. Come love us and join in our song. Come, come."
I dream of mountains. I hear them calling me back home. I hear them calling, calling, come back home. From the reach of the city, where mountains give way to the sky, this is where I long to wander, watching the seasons go by. Nothing can feel more exciting than being there ready to roam. No place could be more inviting. It's calling me, come back home. Let me stand in the heart of a redwood grove, lightly sprinkled with fresh white snow. May I just catch a glimpse of a mountaintop, awash with alpine glow. Let me live out a dream on Yosemite stream, where my wilderness joys abound, to discover the truth of eternal youth upon that sacred ground. Nature awakens my senses when I walk among whispering trees, smelling the sweet scented cedar, breathing a crisp glacial breeze, hearing a soft creature chorus under a star-sparkled dome. Now who will preserve it all for us, so we can come back home? Let me stand in the heart of a redwood grove, lightly sprinkled with fresh white snow. May I just catch a glimpse of a mountaintop, awash with alpine glow. Let me live out a dream on Yosemite stream, where my wilderness joys abound, to discover the truth of eternal youth on that sacred ground. High flowery meadows, sheer canyon walls, huge boulder dams, lacy white waterfalls. Let me stand in the heart of a redwood grove, lightly sprinkled with fresh white snow. May I just catch a glimpse of a mountaintop, awash with alpine glow. Let me live out a dream on Yosemite stream, where my wilderness joys abound, to discover the truth of eternal youth upon that sacred ground. I dream of mountains. I hear them calling me back home. I hear them calling, calling, come back home. I dream of mountains. I hear them calling me back home. I hear them calling, calling, come back home.
As we begin the bountiful month of August in this, our 150th year as a congregation, we pause to glimpse into our past and to wonder at our extravagant good fortune in the natural world and the relationships that enable and nurture this magnificent life. What are our roots, the foundations, and the meaning of the UU seventh principle? Respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. According to one theologian, the Reverend Forrest Gilmore, our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, is a glorious statement. It may be our way of coming to fully embrace something greater than ourselves. The interdependent web, expressed as the spirit of life, the ground of all being, the oneness of all existence, the community-forming power, the process of life, the creative force, even God, can help us develop understanding of ourselves that we and our culture so desperately need, especially now. It is a source of meaning. Throughout the month, there will be opportunities to learn more about our green roots and to live into our aspirations for care of the living earth, not the least of which will happen here today, both in church with John Muir, but also after church as we join Eric from the city of Kent to clean 150 pounds or 150 items of trash from the shore of the Cuyahoga River across the street. So if you have any inclination, come back at 1 o'clock and go with us. So, our month-long inquiry begins now, here, this morning, as we bring our hearts and minds and spirits on a journey with John Muir into nature. Come, let us worship together.
As is the tradition of this church, we join in a shared silence in order to provide an opportunity for personal prayer, meditation, and reflection. I invite you to enter into a few moments of silence, and if you wish, you may use this as an opportunity to delve into your mind and heart, or ponder these words from John Muir. I only went out for a walk and finally concluded to stay out till sundown, for going out, I found, was really going in. I now invite you to participate in creating our prayer. I'll give you an opportunity to share aloud a couple of words during the prayer. So now let us join in a time of reverence. O Spirit of love and life, our hearts ache with the challenges we face. This is a time of great anxiety. We're concerned about the volatile condition of the world, injustice in our land, the lack of compassion by our politicians, and violence and drugs on our streets. Indeed, we must be concerned and continue our work of justice. But the work is hard and exhausting, and we need respite to renew our resolve and our spirits. Let us together bring to mind the often overlooked and unacknowledged blessings that fill our days. Blessings such as an unexpected rainbow, a smile from a stranger, fresh tomatoes. I invite you, as you are so moved, to speak aloud a word or two that lifts up a blessing in your life. For all these blessings mentioned and the many unmentioned and those yet to be recognized, we give gratitude for their power of renewal. May we journey forward with eyes wide open to the blessings offered to us in grace and the blessings that we are. Amen. Our musical meditation today will consist of photographs taken out west by Mary Lou, and quotes written by John Muir.
Many of these pictures Michael Lee took, so I want to give credit. How glorious the landscape! Giant mountains, valleys innumerable, glaciers and meadows, rivers and lakes, with the wide blue sky bent tenderly over them all.
Object is a conductor of divinity, and only by coming into contact with them may we be filled with the holy.
There is nothing more elegant in nature than a mountain stream. Banks with lovely flowers and overarching trees, making one of nature's most hospitable places.
Wonderful how completely everything in wild nature fits into us, as if truly part and parent of us.
The sun shines not on us, but in us. The trees wave and the flowers bloom in our bodies as well as in our souls.
The whole wilderness seems to be alive and familiar, full of humanity. No wonder when we consider that we all have the same father and mother.
Rocks and waters are works of God, and so are men. We all flow from one fountain soul. All are expressions of one love.
Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their own energy into you, while cares will drop off like autumn leaves.
Climb the mountains and get their good tidings.
How glorious a greeting the sun gives the mountains. To behold this is worth the pains of any excursion 1,000 times over.
Today I met a magnificent grass, its home a sunny meadow. It seemed to be fully aware of its high rank and waved with the grace and solemn majesty of a mountain pine.
The mysteriously charming stream's surface is broken to 1,000 sparkling gems, and in their multitude of falls and rapids, they find a voice of song. I'd like to give you a background about John Muir, the subject of today's service. Near the end of naturalist John Muir's life, he was asked by a reporter, "And what is your current occupation?" Muir replied, "A tramp. I'm 74 years old and still good at it." The nature lover who wanted to spend his life tramping the Sierra Nevada mountains of California, in spite of himself, ended his life with considerable fame and wealth, but was still a tramp at heart. His life and spiritual journey are fascinating, although we will only have time to focus on a very small part. I want to begin by encouraging you to consider your own spiritual journey. Now, if you hold the same religious beliefs right now that you held as a child, please raise your hand. We have a couple. For the vast majority of you, you have something in common with John Muir. Now, I invite you to reflect upon your spiritual influences as we delve into the life of John Muir. Muir spent his first 11 years growing up in Scotland. Born in 1838, Muir was the son of a lay preacher who followed a very strict adherence to Calvin's literal interpretation of the Bible and strong perspective of sinful humanity. When Muir's family moved to Wisconsin, he performed long hours of arduous labor under his abusive father. His reading was limited to just the Bible. The Sabbath was the one day that Muir could spend time exploring the nearby wilderness and creating impressive mechanical inventions in his basement. When Muir was 15, friends smuggled books into his house, where Muir read in the wee hours of the morning before his family awoke. His imagination soared with the beauty of poetry and English literature, the intrigue of math, and the adventures of world explorers. Despite his father's approval, Muir was able to attend college for 2 years due to his notoriety as an inventor. While at the University of Wisconsin, Muir became acquainted with the work of Charles Darwin, whose seminal book had been published just 3 years earlier. Muir restricted his studies extensively to botany and geology, although friends introduced him to the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson on transcendentalism. All of this new information challenged the very foundation of Muir's beliefs about life. But at this point, these new ideas existed just as abstract concepts swirling around in his mind. After 2 years, the restless Muir left college to study plants in the wild, saying he was enrolled in the University of Wilderness. Muir had hoped to go south to study the abundant plants in warmer climates, but instead, he walked 400 miles to Canada with his brother, who was going north to avoid the Civil War draft. While there, Muir studied and collected flowers for 2 years. After the end of the war, Muir returned and worked in several American manufacturing businesses where he always excelled by increasing productivity due to his superb mechanical inventions. Muir could have earned an enormous amount of money from his inventions, but he refused to apply for patents, as he believed that inventions should be easily accessible for the greater good. When Muir was 29, while working with a sharp metal filing tool, it gouged his eye. He was blinded in the injured eye and couldn't see with the other eye, which, unknown to him, suffered from sympathetic trauma. For 4 weeks, Muir had to lay prone in bed in a darkened room, agonizing over the belief that he would be blind for life. As he began to regain his sight, the owners of the manufacturing plant where he was working offered Muir a partnership in the business and a high wage. They hoped to retain his services as they recognized Muir's restlessness and tendency to move frequently. Instead, Muir viewed his life with new eyes and vowed to cease his business aspirations as he believed he had become a slave to his machines. He vowed to follow his dream to behold new tropical plants by walking 1,000 miles from Indiana to the Gulf of Mexico. From there, he hoped to travel to South America. Muir set out on his 1,000-mile walk in September 1867, shortly after the end of the Civil War. The following words are from a letter that describe his departure.
As soon as I got out into heaven's light, I started on a long excursion, making haste with all my heart to store my mind with the Lord's beauty and thus be ready for any fate, light or dark. I bade adieu to mechanical inventions, determined to devote the rest of my life to the study of the inventions of God. When they asked where I was going, I said, I don't know, just anywhere in the wilderness, southward. My plan was simply to push on in a general southward direction by the wildest, leafiest, and least trodden way that I could find. I will be accompanied by a compass, towel and soap, a book of Robert Burns' poetry, Milton's Paradise Lost, the New Testament, a 5-pound botanical reference book, and of course, a blank journal strapped to my waist. I will try to delight in journaling as Emerson did. Then, folding my map, I shouldered my little bag and plant press and strode away, rejoicing in splendid visions of pines and palms and tropic flowers in glorious array.
Muir referred to his journey as a floral pilgrimage. Unexpectedly, the next 6 years would also become the powerful spiritual journey of his life. If you are one of those who has experienced a theological change in your life, think about the factors that led to your insights. You've probably been awakened by knowledge gained through reading and conversation with people. Your accumulation of knowledge could have been deliberate, sparked by your curiosity. Or maybe you accidentally bumped into something new that intrigued you. Sometimes circumstances beyond our control force us to examine our beliefs, such as a major life crisis or a near-death experience. John Muir's spiritual life was transformed purely by circumstance. Beginning in his college years and continuing through his 1,000-mile walk and into his early years living in the California mountains, Muir's personal theology would be irrevocably altered, although not without decades of doubt and inner struggles. Muir's months in the wilderness during his walk instilled many life lessons. The most dramatic was the newfound belief that nature is infused with divinity.
This was my method of study. I drifted from rock to rock, from stream to stream, from grove to grove. Where night found me, there I camped. When I discovered a new plant, I sat down beside it for a minute or a day to make its acquaintance and try to hear what it had to say. I asked the boulders I met whence they came and whither they are going. Everything is spiritual, full of influences that I never felt before.
Muir was so overwhelmed by the glory of nature that he gradually began to replace the authority of his childhood religious teachings with pantheistic meaning. Upon sighting his first palm tree in Florida, Muir noted in his journal,
"They tell us that plants are perishable, soulless creatures, that only man is immortal. But I think this is something that we know very nearly nothing about. Anyhow, this palm was indescribably impressive and told me grander things than I ever got from a human priest."
Moving toward further unorthodox thinking, Muir came to strongly dispute the accepted Christian belief that God intended humans to have dominion over all of Earth's creatures.
"How blind are we to the rights of all the rest of creation? Many good people believe that alligators were created by the devil, thus accounting for their all-consuming appetite and ugliness. Fierce and cruel, they appear to us, but beautiful in the eyes of God. They are also his children, for he hears their cries, cares for them tenderly, and provides their daily bread. May alligators long enjoy their lilies and rushes and be blessed now and then, with a mouthful of terror-stricken man. The world, we are told, was made especially for man, a presumption not supported by the facts. A numerous class of men are painfully astonished whenever they find anything which they cannot eat or render in some way what they call useful to themselves. They claim to have precise dogmatic insight on the intentions of the Creator. He is regarded as a civilized, law-abiding gentleman in favor either of a republican form of government or of a limited monarchy, believes in the literature and language of England, is a warm supporter of the English Constitution and Sunday schools. This is as purely a manufactured article as any puppet of a halfpenny theater. With such views of the Creator, it is of course not surprising that erroneous views should be entertained of the creation. It never seems to occur to these far-seeing teachers that nature's object in making animals and plants might possibly be, first of all, the happiness of each one of them, not the creation of all for the happiness of one. Why should man value himself as more than a small part of the great unit of creation? The universe would be incomplete without man, but it would also be incomplete without the smallest transmicroscopic creature that dwells beyond our conceitful eyes.
Muir was repeatedly overcome by transcendent experiences. Transcendent experiences are powerful sensations that overwhelm us with a sense of smallness compared to the immense universe. But at the same time, the experience also enhances our sense of connection to the larger grandeur of life. These experiences in wilderness would cause Muir to frequently drift from ordinary consciousness into states of heightened awareness. Muir clearly speaks using the language of transcendence in exclaiming, "In so wild and so beautiful a region was spent my first day, every sight and sound inspiring, leading one far out of himself, yet feeding and building up his individuality." The influence of New England transcendentalism is certainly apparent in Muir's writings. Yet Muir's understanding of transcendentalism differs from that of the New England Unitarians. A basic tenet of the transcendentalism of Emerson and his contemporaries was the inherent goodness of humans. You may remember this from the UU joke about the difference between a universalist and a Unitarian. The universalist believes that God is too good to sentence humans to hell, whereas the Unitarians believe that humans are too good to go to hell. This belief in the goodness of humans contributed to the decline in followers of transcendentalism beginning in the 1860s. Man's demonstration of cruelty to slaves and the tidal wave of human suffering during the Civil War led to a cynical attitude toward humanity. During his travels, Muir observed firsthand the worst of humans and lost his idealization of humanity. This negative attitude towards humankind, especially the wealthy, is found in these words written after Muir accepted an invitation to join a hunting party.
"Let a Christian hunter go to the gentleman's woods and kill his well-kept beasts, and it is well. But let an enterprising bear go to houses and fields and kill the most worthless person. Oh, that is horribly unorthodox. Well, I have precious little sympathy for the selfish propriety of civilized man. And if a war should occur between the bold beasts and gentlemen, I would be tempted to sympathize with the bears.
Despite Transcendentalism's differing views on humanity, Muir began to embrace its belief that nature manifested divinity and possessed a restorative power. Although Muir was being drawn toward Transcendentalism during his Gulf of Mexico walk, Muir's next journey forever ingrained this belief. From Florida, Muir sailed to Cuba. Muir then journeyed to California rather than pursue his dream to explore the Amazon River Valley. Due to a severe bout of malaria, Muir was left weakened and recuperated while on a boat to California. After arriving at the Sierra Nevada Mountains and living in the wilderness for 5 months, Muir had a mystical experience that he referred to as a conversion. As you shall hear, the God of his childhood, who resided in a heaven separate from earth, was replaced with a profound essence of Godfulness that exists within all earthly creatures and inanimate objects.
Never shall I forget my baptism in this font. It happened in January, the resurrection day for many a plant and for me. I suddenly found myself on one of its hills, the hollow overlooked with light as a fountain, Hollow Creek spangled and mazed like a river, the ground steamed with fragrance, light of unspeakable richness was brooding the flowers. The sunshine for a whole summer seemed condensed into the chambers of that one glowing day. You bathe in these spirit beams, turning round and round as if warming at a campfire. Presently, you lose consciousness of your own separate existence. You blend with the landscape and become part and parcel of nature. Now we are fairly into the mountains and they are into us. What bright, seething, white fire enthusiasm is bred in us without our help or knowledge. How glorious a conversion, so complete and wholesome is it that I have scarce memory of old bondage days of religious past. We rather seem to have been so always. Nature, like a fluid, seems to drench and steep us throughout, as the whole sky and the rocks and flowers are drenched with spiritual life, with God. I will drift about these mountains, movements of divine love, near or far, here or there, willing, dearly loving to be but a servant of servants in this holy wilderness. When night was drawing near, I ran down the flowery slopes, exhilarated, thanking God for the gift of this great day. The settling sun fired the clouds. All the world seemed newborn. Everything, even the commonest, was seen in new light and was looked at with new interest as if never seen before. The plant people seemed glad, as if rejoicing with me, the little ones as well as the trees, while every feature of the peak in its traveled boulders seemed to know what I had been about and the depth of my joy, as if they could read faces. After dark, I groped my way back to the altar boulder and passed the night on it. Above the water, beneath the leaves and stars, precious night, precious day, to abide in me forever, thanks to this immortal gift.
Muir's writings reflected an expansive understanding of God. He used the term cosmic God. Muir's God was no longer unseen. God was visible, and further, the divine spark existed in all earthly creations. Muir proclaimed, every purely natural object is a conductor of divinity, and we have but to expose ourselves in a reverent condition to any of those conductors to be fed and nourished by them. Only in this way can we procure our daily spirit bread. In terms of religious authority, Muir stated, "I will confess that I take more intense delight from reading the power and goodness of God from the things which he made than from the Bible." Churches themselves held no appeal, as Muir lamented, that when, quote, "living trees are cut down and hewn into cathedrals and churches, the farther off and dimmer seems the Lord himself." The tree groves were God's first temples. Muir's childhood theology of a distant God and original sin had indeed been radically transformed. In his 40s, Muir married, left the wilderness lifestyle, and managed his father-in-law's massive fruit orchard operation. He occasionally visited his beloved Sierra Nevada mountains. He grew dismayed by the commercial activities altering the landscape, extensive logging, mining, overgrazing by sheep and cattle, and commercial development. Besides the degradation of the landscape, Muir believed that the crowded and polluted urban areas were leading to diminished health of its inhabitants, especially the poor, who lacked the means to take a respite from city life. Muir believed that nature was needed to counteract the destructive forces of industrialization and city life, and he vowed to use his writing skills to encourage citizens to view the wilderness as having mental and physical restorative powers whose value actually exceeded that of commercial interests, a radical idea during the era of industrialization, social expansion, and growing materialism. Near the end of his life, Muir said in a letter, "The long drawn-out battle work for nature's gardens has not been thrown away. The conscience of the whole country has been aroused from sleep, and good in some form must surely come." And indeed it did. Muir's efforts facilitated the setting aside of 11 natural areas and several national monuments, free access to parks, new scientific knowledge of glaciers, founding of the Sierra Club, and a change in perspective that led citizens to have a more caring relationship with nature. I'll also mention that the song that the choir did at the beginning of the service was a piece of music that was written to honor John Muir. So his inspiration has been felt throughout music, literature, and science, as well as religion. For me, Muir's spiritual journey is particularly interesting because he was such a complex man. Muir was a highly regarded scientist based on his work in botany, glacial activity, and mechanical engineering. Yet he was a mystic who believed that direct experience offered profound knowledge, and he was willing to be changed by what he learned through transcendence. He believed that both science and religion were compatible and worthy of informing meaning in his life. My reading about Muir brought to mind a book I read many years ago titled Wrestling with God. Its author, UU minister Tom Owen Toll, suggests that a mature spirituality needs to be grounded on a foundation of surrender. When I first read that, I had a strong negative reaction to the word surrender. I don't care for that word used in a religious context, as to me it means submission or giving up control to authority. I had trouble understanding the value that Owen Toll placed on the concept until I recently realized how well it exemplifies Muir's spiritual journey. Muir did indeed surrender to the transformative power of nature. He stated, "I care to live only to entice people to look at nature's loveliness. My own special self is nothing." Muir surrendered by placing great reliance upon the use of his senses and feelings, which engaged with the natural world. Owen Toll explains that surrender involves trust, relationship, a willing bond, devotion, and embrace of free falling. But most of all, surrender involves a willingness to be changed. Despite Muir's rational scientific study of nature, he opened himself to an aliveness that exuded from his surroundings. Owen Toll claims that to surrender is an active, not passive devotion. One becomes a co-creator of life through openness, curiosity, and exploration. Muir was certainly not submissive in surrendering. He was an active participant. Perhaps surrendering to that which we find sacred is something that we should consider. Now, Muir believed that the path to nature was the only path leading to a fulfilling spiritual life. But I believe that there are many additional sacred causes to which we can surrender, such as unconditional love, growing in knowledge or creativity, serving others, justice, peacemaking, mystery. What is sacred depends upon what one views as the purpose of life. For those of you who believe that life has no meaning, perhaps surrender means simply living each day to its fullest and surrendering to mindfulness in order to savor each moment. For me, I yearn for hard evidence to support my personal theology, and of course, not finding it, I have had to work on surrendering to uncertainty and unknowing. Although it was hard to accept, I eventually found peace in my surrender. John Muir's spiritual evolution can serve as an inspiration. His example reveals that the search for meaning requires an openness to being transformed through our senses and our hearts. Like Muir, I have found meaning in surrender as my spiritual journey has evolved. What holds ultimate worth for you? I invite you to consider the role of surrender in living your life with intention. May it be so. As we celebrate the 100th anniversary of our national park system, may we honor John Muir and those who struggled to preserve the Earth's natural abundance. Let us go forward with gratitude and bathe in the Earth's rich, life-giving glory and work together to sustain this amazing gift of grace. Go now in peace.